Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to Deal of the Week, Bloomberg's podcast on the world of mergers and acquisitions. I'm Ed Hammond, and I'm joined again this week by Jason Kelly. And also joining us is one of our hedge fund reporters here at Bloomberg, Hema Palmer. The podcast team are cracking the whip this week, even though there is no M&A news really to speak of today. That does not mean there's going to be no show. So we're going to focus on a different kind of angle for us. We're going to look at Wall Street and why Wall Street names certain things the way it does, and a bit around the sort of, I guess more broadly, Jason, correct me if this is wrong, but the sort of nomenclature of Wall Street generally.
What's in a name?
What's in a name? Exactly. That's what we should have called it. What's in a name? We could just go back to the beginning and I could say what's in a name. That's a better setup. But Hema, you wrote this brilliant story right last week that caught both Jason and I's eyes, and it is about hedge funds calling themselves anything but hedge funds to try and get money through the front door. Explain, because this is a great issue and something that I've found annoying for ages at hedge funds, or people say they work in hedge funds and then you find out that actually what they do is nothing to do with hedging at all.
Precisely. So that's kind of the crux of this story, which is looking at investors in hedge funds, some foundations and consultants, and how they go about pitching hedge funds to their clients. And some of them that we spoke to say, you know what, we don't call them hedge funds, partly because they have a bad rap, and partly because really what isn't a name, they don't hedge sometimes. And so they've adopted some other sort of terms like marketable alternatives. They'll say, you know what, we're investing in credit, we're investing in equity, keeping those buckets really broad and fitting a lot more things sort of under them, as opposed to saying, you know what, we're investing in hedge funds, lest people don't understand what you're saying, or pivot to the most negative sort of impression of them.
Right. So you're talking about sort of pensions and endowments and these people who literally have to go to ultimately their customers and beneficiaries,
yes,
right, who sometimes are teachers or firefighters or professors at universities, and they're reading the headlines, they're listening to politicians, and they're saying, whatever you do, don't put me in a hedge fund.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. You know, the board sometimes isn't always aware of the nitty-gritty of picking one manager of another manager, and they just sort of hear the headline stories of this, you know, hedge fund manager is either losing a lot of money or some other concerns about sort of the industry broadly.
And or they're watching the show Billions on Showtime,
or they're watching, right?
Right, or they're reading a New York Post and it's people throwing other people, diminutive people, into swimming pools at parties in Hampton. It's that kind of culture, right? That's the culture we all think of when we think of hedge funds.
Right. And that's certainly not every manager, certainly not everyone in the space, but there is a perception of the industry that I think some are trying to combat. And some of the people that we've spoken to who do, you know, use these different terms, they're still pretty bullish on the industry. They like investing in managers and they try to go for the ones that are most profitable, but also have to mitigate their perception. And there's also a sense of, well, the name hedge fund has evolved. And if you don't hedge, but you charge the fees of a hedge fund and you have the structure of a hedge fund, well, are you in fact a hedge fund? If you don't really go short securities, should you pay 2 and 20 for a fund that's maybe long biased, long only? And then there are some funds that, well, they don't do traditional hedge fund investing, but they do more like direct lending, specialty finance, litigation finance. And they charge these hedge fund fees and they invest in these really unique niches of the industry. But technically, it's not long short. So there's a re-envisioning of this term.
It's wild. It's like this should have happened so long ago.
Yeah.
Right? Because we in the press are partly responsible for this because there's just this lazy culture around, like, we call it anything that does any kind of event or activism or long short, we call them hedge funds, and we call anything that does any kind of buying of non-public assets private equity.
Private equity. Mm-hmm. Well, and this was one of the things, because as Ed well knows and Hema knows well, I'm a total private equity nerd, I admit it. And one of the things that really caught my eye about this story is this is largely what happened in many ways, although much more industry-driven, I think, in the 1990s with private equity, which for a long time was leverage buyouts.
Right.
You know, it was the LBO business. And when you go back to the 80s and you think about the early days of KKR, the very, very early days of Blackstone, which was founded in 85. KKR goes all the way back to 1976. But, you know, they had to shed this image, largely formed by a book called Barbarians at the Gate, which is a seminal work about the LBO business in the late 80s and early 90s. But over the 1990s, people said, well, why don't we call it private equity instead? That sounds much more elegant, and leveraged buyout sort of has this bad reputation. So if we say to people we're doing private equity, maybe they'll give us more money.
But the reputation of private equity, you could argue, is now similarly sullied because people associate it
with time to come up with a new name.
Over-leveraging, sweating assets too hard, firing lots of people.
Right. They got to come up with a new name.
They do. Do you think a movement is underfoot among some of your contacts?
You know, I have had this conversation with people over the years, but nobody can come up with something that is really fits the bill. I mean, there are a couple things that have happened, though. I mean, one is that they started to talk about growth equity as a little bit of a spinoff of sorts or something that sits between venture capital, which venture capital, by the way, has had this amazing reputation for years. And when you talk to people in Washington about venture capital versus private equity, politicians would say, well, venture capital is amazing. They create all these jobs and it's about innovation. And, you know, look at all the companies that have been created by venture capitalists. Private equity, that's Barbarians at the Gate. That's LBOs. That's debt and firing. And Mitt Romney had to carry that around in the 2012 election cycle in a very big way. I mean, the other thing that's happened in private equity is it's expanded to be more alternative assets. So that's one of the euphemisms that's come up that also has, as Hema knows, hedge funds often fall into that
umbrella
as well.
But crucially, if private equity funds just start saying that they are alternative asset managers, they can't really justify charging the fees that they charge because then they just become BlackRocks.
Right. That's true. That's true. Although, you know, and I think this goes back to a key premise of your story, Hema, what the investors really want are the results, right? And right. And if they have to call it something different in order to get that money, because they need this money, they need the money and the profits that these guys are generating, and they just sort of have to, I mean, there's a certain kind of sleight of hand that's happening here, right?
Yes, and I think it is about the money, right? And you go for the managers that ultimately bring you those returns. And it's about informing, I think, the people, your clients, if you're an allocator, trying to get them to pay more attention to what exactly is the strategy, where are we putting your money? And let me explain to you how it works so that you're not maybe focusing on the name, but it's like, okay, they're specifically going to invest in these kinds of things. They're doing this kind of strategy. Trying to inform people is the impression that I got. And that way, it's a lot easier to put that money to work with a manager that you wholeheartedly think is going to make you money, which is really the bottom line.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
So, Ed, have you seen this play out across Wall Street more broadly?
Well, you see, when I think of it in my world, I think of it, well, two bits are irrelevant. Activists, which, you know, we used to call activist hedge funds and now we just call activist investors. And actually, activist hedge funds is a total mischaracterization because a lot of them, they don't hedge.
Yeah, they're just not hedging.
They invest and they bully. But I think there's, and I kind of was thinking about this before we came on.
Bully funds doesn't work so well.
But this is like almost like a PR generated cycle anyway, because, you know, look, if we think of activist hedge funds, they now call themselves engaged shareholders because it sounds better. It sounds more shareholder friendly.
And before
they were engaged shareholders, they were activist hedge funds. So before they were activist hedge funds, they were green mailers. And green mailers, really, it's just like a pejorative term that companies and their PRs came up with for shareholders who were more engaged than they wanted them to be.
Right.
So it's kind of like gone in a big circle. And now, you know, you could say the activists are trying to reclaim the ground. So I think some of it, that plays out some of it on my side. So this is ridiculousness around the names and just, you know, people choosing different names for basically doing the same thing because it makes them seem like a softer touch. And the other area where it's interesting is we see it in the small investment banks who used to be called merchant banks and are now called boutique investment banks, which still to me just sounds ridiculous because it doesn't.
I think they call themselves boutique just to differentiate themselves from the big bulge bracket banks, and also like
post financial crisis,
it's like
a
boutique
cool
hotel. You know, it's like I don't go in for those big nameless, faceless brands.
Right.
This is a more bespoke kind of offering.
So you go into like the Molus office and it's got like purple floor lighting and kind of like weird ambience that you wouldn't necessarily get in Goldman Sachs. That's probably
I'm trying to imagine Ken Molus under a disco ball.
But you know, I think that like a lot of this and the, sort of the overall picture of this comes from us in the media because, you know, there is a, and I said earlier in the show, there is a laziness here. You know, when I talk to lay people, like when I talk to my mum, she works in children's books. Like she calls anyone who's even remotely involved in finance a banker. She doesn't differentiate, right? So you could be in hedge funding, private equity. You could work as a teller in a bank. You're just a banker. She doesn't think about it. But I feel like we in the media are kind of, we partly responsible for this. I mean, like we call Wall Street because it's much easier than actually like breaking down the financial services industry into its composite parts.
I still have to explain what private equity is to people all the time.
I think I understand what it is. It's not always perfectly apparent. But to the point that you were making to Hema, and I would ask you the same thing for private equity. Like if you are actually making money, it doesn't matter whether you have a stupid name or a sensible name, whether you're called something stone, something rock, something river, something tree.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Well, this is interesting. We were going back and forth before the show about sort of the use of like the natural world lexicon in private equity. Like, what is that about?
Isn't there some generator out there,
yes,
Hema, that you can use to come up with your ideal private equity name?
There's a hedge fund generator. Someone online made this fun little gadget online and you press a button and it churns out kind of typical hedge fund names, something walk, something creek, river, capital management.
But why? Like, what does it mean? Why all these like geographical features?
Well, there, and I can speak to this a little bit. I mean, Blackstone actually has a very cool origin story, which is it derives from basically it's Peterson and Steve Schwarzman were the two founders. And so Petra is the stone and Schwartz is the black. So they came up with Blackstone. So in part, they may be to blame. I mean, they were founded in 1985 because we've gotten all, you know, BlackRock was part of Blackstone. So they hold the blame
for that. So it's a kind of weird, like, translative portmanteau of their names.
It is.
Which actually has some meaning.
That's legit. But when you think about all the, like, Crestview and there's one from years ago.
Arrowcross.
Our friend Jonathan Keener and I wrote about Coveview, which is a bit of a mouthful. And, you know, there are lots of different iterations of this.
Yeah.
But I don't totally have an answer as to why people do it. Maybe they...
Hema, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Does it? You've written about this before. Mm-hmm. We found an old story by you, which has this very interesting to me factoid in it, which is that if you have an authoritative sounding word in your name,
mm-hmm,
as a private equity or as a hedge fund, as a hedge fund, you will be able to bring in, and you've got a very exact figure here, $227,000 a year extra. So it obviously does matter having a name that has rock or stone or river or something like that.
Well, per this study, it was a name that has gravitas in the name in some manner. And that, according to the study, and it looked at over 18,000 hedge fund names, said that, you know, these funds that have gravitas-laden names attract more money, especially if the word references economics, nations, and politics. And they do sort of add this sort of hedge in here that, you know, when an allocator realizes the performance of the fund, they adjust their exposure to that fund accordingly, which makes sense. But the very fact that a name could bring you, like, in any measurable amount of increase in capital based
it's
on the name,
it seems insane
name alone.
To me.
And the report actually factored in, controlled for the fund's manager and the fund's performance. They took that out as they examined it.
See, this makes me worried that there's so much dumb money in the world, because that's like saying, like, I trust the guy more because he has, like, some tattoo in Latin on his bicep. It's absurd, right?
And, I mean, we did speak to an actual allocator to gauge the take on the study, and he said, you know what, yes, you know, it has some impact, but obviously they care about the numbers, they care about the track record. I think money will always matter at most, you know, the profits will always be the of utmost importance. But I mean, the fact that it has any sort of bearing at all is kind of fascinating.
And questionable.
Point 72, for example, so we were talking about names earlier. Point 72 is named after the headquartered location in Stanford, 72 Cumming Point Road.
Point 72 being Steve Cohen's
firm.
New firm. Post-SAC.
Right. And it was a family office between.
Right.
Yeah. So it's so that's one situation where there's a reference point to something geographical. I remember one manager speaking to me and explaining the name of their firm, which I don't recall, but it was something kind of random sounding. And they explained the backstory behind it. And it sounded very sort of personal. And I don't know. It struck me as a little removed from the actual,
there are also
manager.
A lot of, second home references and things like that. You know,
childhood homes.
We should say, friend of the podcast, Steve Lippin, who, ex-Brunswick, ex-Wall Street Journal, PR guru, started his own shop late last year.
Gladstone.
And called it Gladstone. And I think Gladstone is the street that he has a house on in Montauk. We actually Google Earthed it and we found the house. And so there you go. We were doing proper journalist work there. So I think, but that is right. There's a lot of second home names in these things.
And you wonder why hedge fund guys get a bad reputation.
Yeah. And why people are trying to call themselves anything but
and sentimental value, I think, too. People reference their childhood.
Anyway, I thought that was a fascinating discussion. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground, and I think next week we'll all try and come up with names for our own private equity and hedge funds. It's now that I'm trying to think of it in my head, it's actually harder.
I think that's our assignment, is to come with something that hasn't been used yet.
And doesn't involve a geographical feature or an animal.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good challenge. So that is it for another episode of Deal of the Week. Thank you very much, Hema and Jason, for joining me for that fascinating discussion. Magnus, our usual producer, is away in Nashville, I think, this week. I don't know what he's doing, but apparently it's very popular there with the Swedes. So I just have to thank Topher Forges, who's producing the show for us this week, and see you again next week.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.